Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. There was a woman, a novelist, called Winifred Holtby, who was English, and right at the height of her power as a writer, and her fame as a writer, and when she was beginning to accomplish what she wanted to do, this was, I believe, in the 1920s, but I'm unfamiliar with the dates. Right at that time, she received a terminal diagnosis from her doctor. And part of what she was going through was an incredible weakness of body. So she had to give up the work that she was doing. She had no energy, felt sick all the time, and was unable to function. And so she experienced an enormous amount of frustration and grief. And she happened to be staying at a friend's place in the country. It was in the winter, although I think maybe more towards spring. But in any case, she was walking out, went for a walk with her cane, and was walking over the fields in the area, which were farms. When she came up over the rise of a hill and saw a group of lambs gathered around a drinking trough that was frozen. The water in it, the top of the water, was frozen. And without thinking, she broke the ice with her stick. And she heard a voice saying, "Having nothing, yet possessing all things." The voice was so strong that she actually looked around for it. And then all her pain, not the physical, of course, but all her ambition and grief and frustration disappeared and never returned. And she counted that moment as the defining one of her life. Now, usually, what we have when we talk about awakening experiences, etc., we only have Asian models. And so I thought I'd use this particular one. Now, in case this story isn't obvious as to what was going on, you had the koan, what we call the koan in daily life of the woman concerned. You had her for a moment, a split second, forgetting about herself. And even though she viewed herself as having nothing, yet with her cane she broke the ice and freed the water for the sheep. This story is an excellent illustration of both what is meant in Buddhism by emptiness, what is meant for monastics of renouncing the world, what is meant by Kensho, Satori, and all those other fancy words, and why such a thing is at such a far distance from experiences that people have as a result of ingesting substances or engaging in exotic practices. During the Buddha's time, there are many, many stories of people's experiences in this way. One of my favorite ones is one of the Buddha's lay disciples who was cooking. She was preparing a meal. Now, I don't recall there's much description of what her practice would have been in a formal way, but no doubt she heard the Buddha, the Buddha's teaching, and practiced it. We don't even know whether she did formal meditation in a meditation hall or meditated on her own or how she practiced other than the precepts. But one day, she was cooking and she wanted to quickly heat up some green vegetables. And presumably she had something like a wok in those days over a cow dung fire, you know, intense heat. And like Chinese cooking, intending to do it really, really fast. So she put the greens in the wok to stir them around, turned away for a moment to attend to something else, and when she looked back, they had completely burnt up. And this, again, was a profound experience. She herself called it the profound experience of impermanence. And she says, the great dark opened. This also is an illustration of the koan, arising in daily life, the intense focus on what one is doing, the intense absorption, the hurriedness, if I can put it that way, when for a moment she turns, looks away, and looks back. In that split second. Another one of my favorite stories is regarding a female monk who, again, practicing, trying to apply the Buddha's teaching to her life. She lived in the lifetime of the Buddha. And at the end of the day, she went into the room where she was staying. And the monastic rule says before you sit down, you should turn around and make sure you're not sitting on something. Okay? Even though it is true that we bow towards our seat and bow outwards, we say recognizing the Buddha nature to some degree, part of its origin is that Vinaya rule. And if you can picture her, she knew, you know, the rule about turning around. Nothing was likely to be on her bed when she sat down, but she turned around to look and then sat down. And she had a type of lamp next to her, actually, which is sort of old kerosene lamps, if you know what I mean, where you turn the, in order to turn it off, you turn it down and the wick goes down. And in those days, you turned it down and it went down into the fuel, you know, it went out. And so she, again, turned it down. And at that moment, for her, she said the great dark was torn apart. And again, we are faced with, within the context of ordinary daily life, not something extraordinary, not something, you know, she hadn't taken ayahuasca before she went in, or, you know what I mean, or did any particular fancy type of exercise, or, you know, thought of three impossible things before breakfast, you know, like Alice in Wonderland. She did something very ordinary. But in each of these cases, for a moment, there was the dropping of self, the dropping of absorption in the self. Training, what we call training, is largely going about doing this. Learning how to act unselfishly, how to train the self. Now, meditation is an excellent way of doing this, because meditation is, even though this is going to sound kind of weird, is actually not doing anything. Okay? That's its virtue. You note that whenever we give descriptions of how to meditate, like Dogen Zazen rules, etc., etc., there's a lot about what not to do. You know, don't chase after the thoughts, don't push them away, don't wear your clothing too tight, you know, don't eat a heavy meal before you sit. There's a lot about what not to do, but there's almost nothing about what you're actually doing. And that is because one goes about meditation in Buddhism by clearing away all the unnecessary. And meditation itself has a quality about it that is beyond our personal control. It's why Buddhism starts off the teaching of the Buddha in that very, very funny place of talking about no separate self. And reams have been spilt on this, and people go round and round the garden talking about it as connection with other people, all sorts of descriptions of it. It is very much basically about the fact that there is no actual grounds for our selfishness. There is actually neither purpose to it, nor reality to it, nor support to it. If we can, for a moment, as Dogen says, let go of it, then wisdom arises. Not wisdom as a type of, which is more what people are used to. People are used to wisdom, the idea of wisdom, as we gain something. You know, we know how to do mathematics when we didn't know how to do it before. Or we know how to do something. Wisdom in Buddhism is completely the other way around. It is gained through letting go. But we are very much used to wisdom as gaining something. So we can almost not imagine what it must be like to let go. And yet, that very letting go is essential. This is somewhat illustrated in, you've probably all heard of the Buddha's first teaching, you know, the turning of the wheel of the law. But what's often missed is that the wheel of the law turned not when Shakyamuni Buddha spoke, but when the disciple understood. If you read that particular scripture very carefully, you'll see that. We tend to think, oh, the Buddha is turning the wheel of the law, you know, and all those statues where the Buddha is doing that. We think, oh, well, the Buddha speaks and the Buddha turns the wheel of the law. But in fact, it was when Kundana, one of the Buddha's disciples, understood that in the story, the Devas say the wheel of the Dharma has been set going at Gaya. It is when it is understood, not so much when it is taught, that the wheel turns. The reference to the turning of the wheel is when it becomes real for another person. Now, because it is like the way I described, it is not the same as a type of self-actualization or self-realization or getting all our ducks in a row, or getting all straightened out, or well-adjusted, or any of those things. It is the letting go of our selfishness, our selfish obsession of having to have things a particular way. If you think of it, the personality, all that we are, is impermanent. Now, you've heard that numerous times. But I mean very impermanent. Particularly, I see a whole rows of people roughly my age or above. You know, all sorts of things are impermanent, as you no doubt, you know. Who would have thought one couldn't get up from a chair? Or bend over, you know? Same body, bit changed, mind you. Or the eyes going, or the hearing, or, you know, all these sorts of somewhat fascinating things, actually. So when we hear impermanence, I sometimes think we really can't understand it short of when we die, you know, because before then we get little taste, but we still think that we are still somewhere in the mix. It is a mistake to think, as many people do, that when they hear the word enlightenment, that it is some sort of state produced by some sort of cause. When in fact, in Buddhism, it's explicitly stated that enlightenment is not caused by anything. We let go of the self, and it is there. How do we go about letting go of the self? Well, there's a very old piece of advice that's in an English fairy tale that I'm rather fond of, called The Water Babies. Some of you might have heard of it. I highly recommend it, even though it is kind of archaic. It was written in the 1800s. And the main protagonist is a chimney sweep who dies and is reborn as a water baby, and who goes through a journey and meets various and sundry people. And I think it's Mother Carey, I think, who he goes to visit because she's supposed to know what's what. And she's sitting just with her hand like that, gazing into the ocean, in the Arctic. And all the creatures are flowing out from her. And he asks her if she's too busy to talk to him. And she said, I'm never more busy now than I am at any other time. And in any case, he asks her about the whole business of her creating things, because she's supposed to be the creator of everything. And she says, anybody can create something if they know how. Anybody can make something. She even talked about somebody who once made butterflies. But to make things make themselves is another matter. I've often thought of River Master Jiu, actually, in terms of that, sitting still in the middle of the community, making things make themselves. So the advice that she gives, if my memory is right, that in order to become an adult, and in this case a spiritual adult, you have to be willing to go where you don't want to go, do what you don't want to do, and help somebody you don't want to help. I think that this is a very excellent description, certainly, of monastic life, and also of training in general, and also a very good description of what it means to be an adult person. training, I remember with Reverend Master, for example, she had a disciple who was troubled on two legs, I must confess, and created an enormous amount. I'm not going to mention any names. Person is not present. But created an enormous amount of trouble for everybody. Maybe overly sincere, I don't know. I remember a science fiction story once where this woman, Ursula Le Guin, and this woman had achieved a revolution in society. But she was looking back over her life, and her husband had died in one of the revolutions. And whenever he would say to, she would say she had to be true to herself, and he would say, "Can't you be true to yourself a little at a time?" He was the one who got killed. Anyway, I need to find my way back. Where was I? Ah, thank you, thank you. That's what abbots are for. And in any case, I happened to be there, and the person that caused an enormous amount of trouble stomped out of the monastery and went tearing up the I-5. And there was a general sort of, although Buddhists wish to be compassionate and charitable, sometimes when some people go, you're kind of glad to see the back of them for a while anyway. And in any case, I was in her room, Reverend Master's room, when the call came in from phone watch that the person was on the phone. And I watched Reverend Master, you know, shade come over her face. And she said to herself, "Come on, Peg." Picked up the phone and responded to it. Now, no doubt she didn't want to. You know, no doubt she would sooner have done almost anything else except do that. But, you know, and so each of these people I mentioned earlier were doing the next thing. And that always seems very mundane, but that is where the experience of insight occurs. Like one of our ancestors in the ancestral line, to tell you the truth, I can't remember which, somewhere around Monson, had an awakening experience in an outhouse when the wind blew the door to and smacked the door loudly against the, you know, closing it. Now, it would have been a mistake for that person to think that the outhouse door was causing, do you see what I mean? But it's such a grave temptation in the way that Zen is written about and explained to think that. And if it helps, a lot of these stories in the Zen tradition, particularly in Japan and China, the Zen tradition was into paring down things, as we know. So they pared down the stories to the very barest part of them, assuming that anybody hearing the stories would know all about the ins and outs and would probably have heard the stories before. So that's why the stories often end up being slightly mysterious or giving the impression that, you know, shithouse doors cause people to awaken to enlightenment. Anything can do so, as Dogen says. Now, in the beginning, and most people here who I'm talking to have been training for, you know, some period of time. And one of the reasons I wrote a pamphlet on how to meditate was not aimed at new people, but aimed at people who have been meditating for some period of time. Because when you're giving meditation instruction initially, it's kind of like you're describing an experience that the person has not had. So you're trying to do the best you can. I have a metaphor that goes through my mind, which is going to sound kind of violent. I view giving meditation instruction as like one of those old Bugs Bunny cartoons where there's a person walking along the street and there's a piano being moved. you know, up above. And this is going to sound dreadful, but this is what sometimes it feels like. One is positioning the person to receive maximum piano impact. Or you can call it being grabbed by the cosmic Buddha, too, if you like. And you, I feel like, you know, like just a little bit over there, and I keep one eye on the piano. Yeah, a little bit over there. Now, stay still. Because in all of this of training and teaching, there is the teaching, there's the teacher, there's the student. But then there is what Reverend Master called the third position, or the cosmic Buddha, or whatever name is used for it. And as I once explained to a Catholic monastic, Buddhism is a process-oriented. We don't have much to say about the goal, but we've got lots of instruction about what to do along the way. Don't do that, do that. So the importance of letting go of selfishness, and that as one one's relationship to the meditation and to the training changes, the more you do it over a period of time. And which I'm sure a good number of you know about, which in a way that it is impossible to explain before the experience, which is why we tend to do things like just sit, if you know what I mean, and not do much in the way of explaining. But I thought that given how little this area is talked about, I would do so. And though I have a reputation for talking at length, I think I am done.